funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
When you hear this voice, what sort of person do you imagine?
I'm not satisfied because I'm in my 40s and still single. I'm not the most confident person at the moment.
When the owner of that voice, David Thorpe, stopped to listen to himself, he thought he sounded gay. This is Think on KERA. I'm Chris Boyd. In fact, David Thorpe is gay, and he's okay with that. But he was ambivalent about the fact that his voice might communicate his sexual orientation to people, whether or not he felt it was any of their business. So he set out on a campaign to change his voice, recording video as he went, and found himself launching both a path to self-discovery and a number of interesting conversations about why some people are perceived to sound gay at all and what that means. The new documentary by journalist and filmmaker David Thorpe is called Do I Sound Gay? It opens this weekend at the Texas Theater in Dallas. David, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for having me.
This is such an interesting thing to explore because a voice that, in air quotes, sounds gay is one of those things that many people might be able to identify without being able to articulate why. What is a gay voice?
Well, you know, it's funny that you say that because when I started this project, I myself wasn't really sure what sounded gay. But, you know, after doing many, many interviews, it became clear very quickly that for most people, a so-called gay voice is an effeminate voice. So that is a man who has certain characteristics of speech that sound that are more typical or people think are more typical of women. So some of those are things like a sibilant S, which in fact women tend to have a higher and longer S than men in general. Hyper-articulating your speech, so particularly at the end of words, so like continent instead of continent. A more melodious voice, which is actually not more typical of women, but is perceived as more effeminate. So that's kind of, you know, hi, how are you? And a higher voice, a voice in a higher register.
Interesting when you talk about the sibilant S, because one thing that science has confirmed is that the old stereotype of gay men lisping is not true. Sexual orientation has nothing to do with whether or not you develop that particular speech impediment.
That's completely accurate. There is no evidence that gay men lisp at any higher rate than men who aren't gay or who don't sound gay. But the S has always been a signature sound of gayness, especially in Hollywood and TV from the 20s on. And, you know, nobody really knows exactly why the lisp stereotype began, but, you know, it seems to have something to do with the fact that the S is a particularly provocative sound for people who are homophobic.
Okay, I want to talk about those stereotypes and sort of, absorbed homophobia from the culture. I had never given it a bit of thought, but it seems that somebody working at Disney for a very long time decided that villains sounded stereotypically like gay men.
Well, it wasn't just Disney. I mean, this was true of Hollywood in general, particularly in the 40s when film noir came into vogue. Film noir villains were often kind of elite, effeminate, kind of sophisticated men who were coded as gay. And I think, you know, people know Strangers on a Train. Bruno is a great example of that. He's very close to his mother and he's very, you know, fussy about his nails. And so I think what was going on with the Disney films really reflected a wider cultural shift where in the 20s and 30s, gay men were often portrayed as kind of comic relief figures, best known as the pansy, which was really kind of what gay men were called then. And in the 40s, in the post-war era, things really start to shift. And gay people, gay men and women are seen as threats to kind of, you know, the domestic dream and marriage plot of films and society.
Peter Pan will be blasted out of Neverland.
I thought perhaps you were entertaining someone up there in your coils.
Oh, my dear Bartholomew, I'm afraid that you have gone and upset me. You know what happens when someone upsets me.
Perhaps I can divine a solution to this thorny problem.
Oh, I shall practice my curtsy.
Well, as far as brains go, I got the lion's share, but when it comes to brute strength...
I'm afraid I'm at the shallow end of the gene pool.
That was a collection of Disney villains, Captain Hook, Peter Pan, Shere Khan from The Jungle Book, Scar from The Lion King, and I think a couple others were in there as well.
It's pretty convincing when you play them all together like that.
It is. At what point, I mean, obviously those are all so over the top, but I want to talk about you having this sort of a midlife crisis. You'd had a relationship end. This is where some people go to the gym or find a shrink. What made you zero in on your voice?
That's a great question. I'd always been self-conscious about my voice because I was teased and bullied as a kid for being effeminate and sounding effeminate. And I think for me, you know, I've always felt that my voice was my tell. My voice was what gave me away as gay. And I've had, you know, a number of experiences that made that clear. So, you know, I was feeling vulnerable and low for a number of reasons that I talk about in the film. And my midlife crisis was less about, you know, what does it all mean and where's my life going, and more about, you know, feeling like I'm going to be alone forever. I had just broken up with a boyfriend. And, you know, maybe all those people who said that being gay was wrong were correct. Maybe this is my punishment. Maybe I am doomed to be a lonely, bitter old queen. So, you know, it makes sense that I went looking for the shortcut that I perceived to be the biggest impediment to kind of just fitting in better, both in straight culture and in gay culture. You know, I think it's helpful to think of it as people going for plastic surgery or going to the gym or taking a pill. It seemed like a good practical answer.
Did it bother you that it bothered you to sound gay?
It did. I was ashamed of having shame, which might seem like a funny concept to try to grasp. But, you know, I interviewed David Sedaris in the film, and he very poignantly talks about his own kind of lingering feelings of shame.
You know what? I was going to say, we actually have that sound. So let's play that, and then we can talk about it. Hold on 1 second.
I mean, I'm embarrassed to say this, but, you know, sometimes somebody will say, I didn't know you were gay. And it's like, why does that make me feel good? You know? And I hate myself for thinking that. And I think, yeah, it's very disturbing. I thought I was beyond that. What's the problem if somebody assumes that I'm gay when I open my mouth? Like, why do I have a problem with that?
So, David, is that something you can relate to?
Yeah, I related to what David Sedaris says very, very deeply. And it was very liberating for me to hear him say it because he's, you know, internationally famous and successful. And I would never have thought somebody in his position would still have kind of lingering shame about being gay and feel good when he is mistaken for straight. And in some ways, that interview with David gave me permission to have the feelings I was having. You know, we're so focused on sort of gay pride and fighting for equality, and as well we should be. But, you know, you don't snap your fingers and suddenly love yourself when you come out, or at least a lot of people don't. It takes time to unlearn the messages that you grew up with, you know, especially depending on your background. And, you know, for me, it was clear that I was in my 40s and I had a lot of shame about being gay and therefore sounding gay that I hadn't dealt with.
There's an interesting, it's a little moment in the film, but you're talking to your grandmother about whether she was surprised when you came out, and she said yes. And then she says something like, we'd never had to deal with anything like that before, as if you had had like a terrible disease or a car accident, and not just that she learned this thing about her grandson that she loved.
Yes, my poor grandmother. She does say in the film that I always seem so normal, and it was really surprising when I came out. And of course, you know, audiences are always a little shocked by that because today, you know, being gay is normal. But I think it showed how different things. I think her comment shows how different things were in the 80s, especially when I was growing up, and gay people just kind of didn't exist in many places, at least not, you know, on the out in the open and kind of in polite society.
So one of the things that you explored was this idea of code switching that lots of people do who are part of a variety of different subcultures. I always think it's an interesting aspect of people's personalities, but it's one thing to choose to code switch, and it's another thing to feel as if you have to in order to fit in and be accepted.
Exactly. And that was one of the big questions that I had for myself was, you know, am I code switching because I'm ashamed of being gay, so I'm butching it up at the gas station or at the sports bar, or is that just a natural part of how we all fit in and kind of get along? You know, and again, it was liberating for me to learn that everybody code switches, that code switching extends to something as simple as, say, talking to kids. So when you meet a young boy or girl, you might say hello like this, and how are you, and what's your name? And you adopt a really different way of speaking. And it is completely natural to sort of change the way you speak depending on who you're talking to. And I still code switch. I still find, you know, when I'm with a group of, you know, straight guys and, you know, at my volleyball pickup game, you know, I can find myself lapsing into sounding straighter. But now I kind of have a new reflex, which is, you know, you don't have to sound this way. These people will accept you no matter how you are. And that is something I didn't have before I started this project.
Yeah, I was thinking so much about this made me think about the issue of a voice that is gay or straight or perceived to be so. But it also made me think about the ways in which our voices really communicate more to other people about us than we realize they do. Regardless of the content, we gather a lot of information based on accent and tone of voice. And I feel like my memory of voices of people I've been very close to is clearer sometimes than my memory of their faces.
It's true. Voices are a really essential part of our identities and also how we, you know, think of other people and the judgments we make of other people. And it's funny, we spend so much time obsessing over our appearance, you know, our bodies or how we dress. But we don't actually think nearly as much about all the complicated ways that our voices communicate information. I think when you're a minority, it's a little more on your mind, because minorities, you know, are, I think, more aware of how conspicuous they are. You know, I feel that my voice makes me more conspicuous as a gay person. If you're Black, it might be wearing like an afro is going to make you more conspicuous as a Black person. Or if you're Muslim, you know, it's one thing for your colleagues to know you're Muslim. It's quite a different thing to wear a headscarf to work. So I think, you know, some of us have been trained to be keenly aware of how every signal we put out might trigger a reaction.
My guest is journalist and filmmaker David Thorpe. His new documentary, Do I Sound Gay, opens this weekend at the Texas Theater in Dallas. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, we have lines open at 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter @ChrisBoydThink.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education. Fall registration is now open with courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. Our guest for the hour is journalist and filmmaker David Thorpe. His new documentary, Do I Sound Gay?, is available on demand video for with whatever service you happen to use. You can also see it starting next Friday at the Texas Theater in Dallas. If you'd like to join our conversation, call 1-800-933-5372. David, how does one go about finding a speech therapist to work on sounding less gay if, in fact, you perceive that to be a problem?
Well, you know, it turns out to be relatively easy in theory because it is fairly simple to kind of isolate, you know, things about a person's speech that sound, quote unquote, gay because there is a standard way that men speak. So, for example, and it's even called a standard American melody, and men tend to use it more than women. So, for example, going down at the end of your sentence, that's the standard American melody. Where you know you're being very authoritative, so that's a huge one for a lot of people, especially because upspeak has become so normalized. That is, you know, people tend to go up at the end of their sentences, but you know, other exercises to limit or retrain you to change, say, the way you hit your consonants, so you're not hitting your consonants so hard. Your S's are not as hissy now. I do want to say that the voice coaches I worked with are not out there advertising to help people sound less gay. They tend to work with actors and business people who, as part of their professional work, are kind of obliged to meet a certain standard of speaking.
I was really glad that this came up in the film because one can be mistaken about the sexual orientation of someone you meet based on the sound of their voice. You introduce us to one friend who grew up with a pack of brothers. He happens to be attracted to men, but he does not sound gay in the way that most people would imagine that to be. And then let's listen here to your friend, Chris.
We need a chard, a red cabbage, and two strawberries.
As one friend put it, my voice is all treble, no bass, I guess.
And Chris, David Thorpe is a straight guy.
That's right. He is straight. And I think most people upon meeting him would not think so. You know, we tend to be very kind of, I think, trapped in our assumptions about people. And, you know, I think in modern life, we tend to need to put people in categories very quickly. And when we see how somebody walks or talks or what they're wearing, they just kind of go into, you know, the gay box or the straight box or the you know, preppy box or the, I don't know, the nerd box. And we trust those assumptions way too much. And the science does show that when it comes to voice, it's not a reliable way of judging sexual orientation.
Did you put Chris in the gay box when you first met him?
Well, I went out and found Chris as I was looking for a straight guy who had been told he sounded gay. And I found many of them. But when I asked them, when I told them about my project, many of them did not return my calls. And then when I set up interviews with, say, the remaining five, none of them returned my calls to confirm, except for Chris. So, I mean, that just shows you, you know, that how much stigma there is around sort of being effeminate for some people, because none of them were even willing to sit down and have a conversation with me off camera about it.
And Dan Savage, the sex columnist, argues in the film that the disdain for a gay voice or an effeminate voice is about misogyny. It's bad to sound gay because it's bad for any man to resemble a woman in any way.
Yeah, that's a hard truth that Dan lays out in the film. And I think it's something that a lot of people know intuitively but maybe haven't thought about, you know, explicitly at any point. But yeah, misogyny and homophobia are kind of evil twins, but they're both evil, unlike other sets of twins. You know, exactly. Homophobia, you know, I think at root is a fear of men acting like women. And, well, what's wrong with acting like a woman? Well, that's our fear of women. And that, you know, who would want to adopt the, you know, the clothing or the speech or the beliefs or the lifestyle of the what is supposed to be the second-class citizen, the less valued member of society. And, you know, that kind of sexism has, I'm guessing, been with us for millennia, and it really bubbles up everywhere and is hard to get past.
To throw another layer on the onion, if that's even an expression, one thing that you discovered in the film was that a lot of gay men report that they're not that attracted to a potential partner who has a voice that sounds particularly gay.
In the film, I do interview a number of gay men who say that, you know, in bed or, you know, even sort of in searching for a partner, that they are put off by a man who sounds too effeminate. And again, I think that's partly the misogyny at play, that, you know, we're all looking for a real man. But the reality, of course, is that lots of men end up, you know, lots of gay men are in stable relationships or serial monogamy. And, you know, I don't want to say that it's, I don't think it's a hugely widespread prejudice, but it is a prejudice that is very much on the surface, say when you're single or when you're making snap judgments about people. And, you know, one person, one journalist recently wrote an article about how he initially wasn't interested in his current boyfriend because of the way his boyfriend speaks. So it both played a role in his, you know, in his lack of attraction, but he kind of saw past it.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's speak with Cameron in Plano. Hi, Cameron.
Hi, Chris. It's great to talk to you guys. Yeah, I just had a comment. I am a voice actor and a singer, and a lot of my hobbies and professionalism revolves around my voice. And I found that a lot of times when I put on maybe a more feminine quality to my voice when I'm putting on a character, I have this release, this feeling of release, that I'm being more true to myself even. I hang around a lot of heterosexual people, especially being a very recent Austin transplant. And I find that when I'm around my gay friends, of course, my more effeminate qualities come out. So I just, you know, wanted to offer that there is that sense of release whenever I put on more of a gay voice.
Thanks so much for your call. What do you think about that, David?
That's a lovely comment. I mean, it reminds me of when I do drag. You know, there's this, I think a lot of us have to suppress some of our, you know, feminine gender expression because we were told it was bad. It still can be provocative to people. And I don't think that's just gay guys. I mean, I know a lot of straight guys who like putting on a dress. You know, we live by all of these rules about how we're supposed to be. And it can be incredibly liberating, as your caller said, when you get to break them. Yeah, that was a lovely thing to hear. I mean, I think people who work in theater and in film, you know, are particularly under pressure to act a certain way in real life because casting directors tend to see them as they are and less, you know, as the role they might be able to play.
What did you learn from speech pathologists about the thinking behind where a gay voice comes from? Why, to the extent that it is more common among men who actually are gay, how does that happen?
Well, your caller was, you know, talking about how when he's around his gay friends that he tends to sound more gay. And, you know, there are sort of two main theories as to why someone might sound quote-unquote gay or not. I do want to emphasize that there is no such thing as a gay voice. There's no voice that every gay man has, and it's limited to gay men. It's simply a voice that sounds more stereotypically gay, which is to say more stereotypically effeminate. But the two main ways that linguists and experts think that men sound gay is when they're growing up, if you tend to affiliate more with women and you tend to identify more with women, you acquire language from role models and people you trust. And there are subtle differences in the way that men and women speak. So the sibilant S is a great example. There and other kind of micro variations. And it's not just gay boys. It's any boy, like Chris in the film, who is straight, but has a more stereotypically effeminate voice. But there's also something called camp speech, which is, kind of a more over the top or purposefully effeminate way of acting, that when there are groups of gay men together who are letting off steam or kind of working through the anxieties of the pressure of the stereotypes that society puts on them, sometimes, you know, you have a drink and you start to sound, quote unquote, more gay. And it's very liberating, as your caller said.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go now to Thomas in Mesquite. Hi, Thomas.
Hello. Thanks for taking me.
Sure.
I just wanted to say I understand it really resonated to me whenever he was talking about how other cultures, not just limited to gay people, change the voice around. Like, this is how I naturally sound, but if I'm talking on NPR, I'm going to change my voice to try to sound more intelligent. People tend to think I'm not smart because of the way I sound. So I just wanted to say that I do change my voice from what I usually sound like, you know, in certain scenarios. But also I wanted to throw this out as well. Is it possible, I have a friend who's gay, and he's ostracized in the gay community occasionally for trying to be masculine because he doesn't have the stereotypical gay voice. And he's talked to me about this issue before. How much does he think it's possible that people put on this gay accent to, like, kind of show to other members of the community, oh, I'm gay, or try to fit in? But I just want to say I 100% agree with him. You know, I don't sound smart. I got to change my voice up if I try to sound smart. And thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for calling. Let me just say, Thomas, before we have a response from David, you sound plenty smart to me, and nobody at NPR would want you to change your voice. You sound perfect.
Yeah, I mean, what he expressed is a really common feeling among people who know they're being judged against a standard. And in the film, Margaret Cho and Don Lemon respectively talk about, you know, sounding too Korean or sounding too Southern and too Black, and their, you know, anxiety in dealing with that pressure. And I have heard this question quite a bit, that are gay men putting on the gay voice? And it's a really interesting question. I mean, I think by and large, the simple answer is no. I think 99% of, people who sound gay, that's really how they talk. And it's, you know, I think it's funny to gay people sometimes when people who aren't gay think that we're making, you know, that we're acting that way on purpose, because it's not a great advantage in society to sound especially effeminate. But that said, we all play roles and we all put on masks and we all do code switch. And, you know, there are times when, you know, if you're a fraternity brother, you're going to embrace that fraternity brother role more than others. And, you know, without a doubt, there are times when gay men camp it up and add a knowing wink or an extra layer of gayness because the moment calls for it. But by and large, your gay friends sound how they really sound.
I thought it was interesting that you sought out George Takei for the film, who famously has an incredibly deep and masculine and commanding voice, is publicly out and very proud of his identity. What did he tell you about how he thinks about the sound of his voice?
It's funny that you think of him as having a masculine voice, and it shows how subjective these judgments are, because to me, he sounds very campy, certainly much more so now than when he was Mr. Sulu. But he was playing a role then, of course.
That was 40 years ago.
Yeah. And he's since come out, you know, and I think his voice may have changed. I, of course, went to George because he is so iconic, specifically for his voice. And it is so, you know, it can be seen as very masculine and authoritative and having a lot of charisma and presence. And what was funny was I kind of went to him like, you know, climbing the mountain to talk to the wise guru for the answer to life. And he was kind of like, I don't know. I don't know why people love my voice. He was, you know, he said, I'm an actor. I was trained. you know, I spent a little time in London when I was young, but it was kind of funny that he didn't have, you know, some giant pearl of wisdom. I mean, we certainly talked about, you know, exercises you can do and, you know, what makes a voice better and what doesn't. But I think it's a natural gift he has. And of course, that is part of it, too. I mean, we all have, you know, gifts and things that don't rise to that level.
Did Don Lemon, who you also interview for the film, did he think that if he had sounded more stereotypically gay, that that would have been an impediment to his career?
Well, he didn't come out and say that, but it's very, you know, I think it's pretty strongly implied in the clips that you see from him. You know, he confesses to having worried that he sounds gay. He also said that, you know, he would listen to his voice and recognize that it sounded too Southern and too Black for him to do what he does. And he's absolutely right that, you know, at least sort of today, for the most part in the mainstream media, especially on television, there really is a standard voice for men and to some degree for women. And when you think about that voice tends to be stereotypically straight and stereotypically white. And Don, in the film, you know, refers to the fact that when his friends back home hear him on CNN, they razz him for sounding white.
We're speaking this hour with journalist and filmmaker David Thorpe. You can see his documentary, Do I Sound Gay, via on-demand video. It will also open next Friday at the Texas Theater in Dallas. We'll come back to our conversation in a couple of minutes. Join it by calling 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education, offering the SMU Certificate Program, where you can take courses in art, architecture, history, literature, and more. Registration online at smu.edu/CAPE.
This is Think. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking with David Thorpe about his new documentary, Do I Sound Gay? You can find it on demand or see it starting next Friday at the Texas Theater in Dallas. Our number is 1-800-933-5372. So, David, when I was 13, my family moved from Long Island, New York to El Paso, Texas. And I showed up at school for the first day of ninth grade talking like this, and I didn't think it was very strange. And then people gave me a lot of, like, why do you talk that way? And very deliberately, over the course of approximately 36 hours, I had lost my Long Island accent. But I could do that without looking back. I wasn't going to disappoint anyone who thought, why don't you talk like me anymore and what's wrong with the way I talk? On the other hand, if you feel like your voice sounds gay and you have a lot of dear gay friends who may also speak the same way, were you worried that you would hurt people's feelings in attempting to adjust this part of yourself that resembled something that all your friends had?
I was terribly worried about how people would react to my, you know, whole project of talking about sounding gay and not, you know, very honestly saying, look, I'm at a place where, like, I'm not that thrilled that I'm sort of sound so visible or audible. But I also clung really defiantly to my belief that I had the right to be who I was. And if it turned out that I was more comfortable as a more conservative version of myself, then I thought I had the right to do that. You know, I'm bald and I used to be a journalist, and I once did a story about wearing a wig. And I did that story because I was becoming uncomfortable with being bald as I got older. And, you know, in some ways wearing a wig is silly, and why would you wear a wig? But, you know, on the other hand, if I'd be happier wearing a wig, I'd wear a wig. So You know, I knew that there might be pushback, but I also just thought I need to be happy and I need to resolve this for myself. Instead, however, you know, every gay man I talked to started to open up and share his own experiences around his voice. Or if it wasn't his voice, maybe it was his gestures or the way he walked. And I discovered that there was kind of this vast untapped reservoir just beneath the surface of our kind of happy urban gay lives that a lot of people had lingering shame. One of my own best friends, it turned out, hated his voice. He thought it was the worst thing about his whole, you know, personality and life. And so opening up that dialogue changed everything for me and helped me start to move past the shortcut of you know, how do I fit in better and how do I accept and celebrate who I am.
We have an email here from Sam in Fort Worth who wants to know what you learned about stereotypical gay voices in other languages. I know you went to France working on the doc.
Yeah, that's a great question. You know, there's not a ton of research about sexual orientation and voice compared to some other, you know, linguistic topics. But linguists speculate, and I think it's a good speculation, that there are men who sound gay in every culture because sounding gay is, again, just shorthand for sounding effeminate or having some speech patterns or, you know, features that are more typical of women. So, you know, they're different than in English for sure. But whatever women do is going to be considered gay if men do it. In cultures where gayness exists, you know, there are places like Iran where officially there are no gay people. But, you know, I've spoken to many Iranians and of course there are effeminate men in Iran, but the voice is ignored or looked past as definitive evidence. Whereas in the U.S., when you hear a gay voice, it constitutes irrefutable evidence that that person is gay.
Is there anything helpful to you, like in the shorthand, and as we've discussed, it doesn't necessarily, the sound of one's voice doesn't necessarily indicate anything definitive about their sexual orientation, but if you were to pick up the phone and talk to somebody, does it help you to think, okay, I think I can identify this as a straight man or a gay man or whatever?
Absolutely. I mean, when I'm on the phone, I make judgments about the voice that I'm hearing all the time. And I also hear a lot of funny stories about people making the wrong judgments. Like, oh, I thought I was talking to a middle-aged African-American woman, and it turned out to be like a 20-year-old white sorority girl. you know, there's just so many funny misapprehensions in that way. And, you know, I'm lucky because I've spent the last 4 or 5 years thinking about this and working on this. And when I hear a voice that sounds a certain way, I also have this reflex, which is that doesn't mean that, you know, the person is Latino or the person is a younger woman or the person is gay. And for me, it's actually really quite a pleasure to sort of make judgments, but not, you know, not necessarily just, you know, take a note, but not assume I know who or what someone is, because inevitably people are so much more complicated than the boxes we put them in when we first meet them.
Let's go to the phones now. We'll speak this time with Kayla in Denton. Hi, Kayla.
Hi. David, in your film, did you explore the gay voice versus regional accents? Because it would seem to me that the gay voice or gay accent, if you will, really just speaks to an accent that all you can determine is sexual orientation, whereas, like, say, Texas accents, I can tell if someone's from Laredo versus East Tyler simply by their accent, whereas the gay voice may sound kind of like a Silicon Valley girl from California. It doesn't seem to matter where the gay person is from. The gay accent just sounds the same.
Well, that's a great point, in the sense that you know, sounding gay seems to immediately mean that person is gay no matter where you are. But I do, you know, I do want to, you know, emphasize that the voice, while it might trigger that judgment that someone is gay, it really isn't definitive evidence in any shape or form and is often incorrect. But yeah, it is distinct from, you know, one of the phenomenons of the gay voice is, in fact, that, you know, you could be a 13-year-old in Iowa and never met a gay person but sound gay. And again, I can't emphasize enough that this is not about sexual orientation. It's about gender affiliation and gender identification. So in some ways it is like an accent because you can learn it, you can unlearn it. But in other ways, it's not definitive. When you meet someone, with an accent from a region, you can do a pretty good job of determining where they are from. However, I would say we've all had experiences where we hear an accent and we think, oh, that person is from France and they're from Montreal, or maybe they're from Spain or Italy. So, you know, these judgments are often as wrong as they are right.
What did you take away from working on your voice?
Well, the biggest takeaway for me, no matter what, kind of field I was exploring, was how my voice is a physical part of me, that I have a vocal tract with vocal cords that are muscles that can be strengthened, that my lips and my tongue and where I place my tongue are all part of how I sound. And I can deploy all of those muscles and machinery to make my voice. And I think learning, grasping that my voice was not some black hole that just sort of happened and came out the way it came out, but rather a physical part of me, was like a huge breakthrough for me, because, in some ways it's no different than learning how to play, using your voice is like, learning how to play the cello or learning how to swing a baseball bat. It's just a part of life like anything else. And there was so much emotional baggage attached to my voice, and I felt so, I felt like that I should change it to be one way or another. And when I actually learned, a little more in detail about how voices work and how much it's simply a product of my body, that was a big breakthrough for me.
Did it bother you that, I don't know, if you encountered people who said, how do you even see a problem here? And how dare you get so upset about this thing that shouldn't really matter? Like, in the same way that, maybe people would understand if you had a body image issue or something that was evident only to you. Did they discount your desire to at least explore what you might do to have a greater sense of control over your own voice?
I think some people got exasperated because I was taking them back to a place that they felt they had already been passed. But, overwhelmingly, unfortunately, but fortunately for me, most people have some body image issues, most people have some voice issues. And it was much more common for people to identify with my anxiety than to scold me for it. And I think even the scolding was pretty loving. But, I think, we always hear this message, be yourself. But it's one thing it's just so much easier said than done. And I think you need really good reasons to be fearless about who you are and find, real solid grounding for kind of your self-worth and your self-esteem. And so people would say to me, why can't you just feel better about it? But I had to go out and work through it and understand where all my feelings came from, both small and large and both shallow and deep, in order to work through it.
Let's go back to the phone here. We have Jacob on the line in Plano. Hi, Jacob.
Hi, Chris. Hi, David.
Hey.
Hi.
So I actually was wondering whether or not, David, you would notice that if there were specific subsets of the gay population that you talked to that seemed more concerned about their voice, or whether it was sort of a unilateral concern. I'm thinking really specifically in terms of racial demographics. I know you talked sort of about the learned aspect of the accent, and a lot of times I know people of certain races feel an obligation to sort of represent that in the way that they speak. And with regard to sort of making an intersection between, gay speak and maybe the way that they think that people within their race should sound, Jack McFarland might be an ostensibly gay character with a voice that sounds stereotypically gay, but he's also a white character, and it doesn't necessarily, his experience or the way that he speaks might not necessarily intersect as well with other people's race. And I'm sort of wondering if you'd noticed that or noticed that people had that concern.
Thanks for your call.
That's a great That's a great point. And yes, it means something different to sound gay if you're white or, you know, if you're Latino or if you're from, you know, say, you know, India, where it's less okay to be, you know, visible or audible as a gay person. You know, I looked at race and gender and class primarily through the lens of my own life for storytelling purposes. So, you know, I spoke more generally about all of those issues in ways that mirrored the anxiety about sounding gay. So, you know, Don Lemon and Margaret Cho talk about their anxiety about sounding too Korean or too Black or too Southern. But, you know, absolutely, we're all at the intersection of class, race, gender, and it's very hard to separate anything out at any one point.
Is there any equivalent speech pattern seen to identify lesbian women?
Well, it is true that, of course, there are more masculine-sounding women. I always like to bring up Kathleen Turner as an example, because she just has the most wonderful, deep voice. But, you know, she's also a good example because, you know, the big difference around voices for men and women in terms of cross-gender features is that, you know, a deep or more masculine voice from a woman doesn't trigger the same homophobia or fear in the way that a man who sounds gay or sounds effeminate does culturally. I talked to a lot of women, a lot of experts, and a very strong consensus emerged that that visual cues like a haircut or the way a woman dresses or walks seem to be much more provocative to people who are homophobic or, you know, stereotyping women than a woman's voice. And there are probably a lot of different reasons for it, but of course there are women who sound more masculine, but it's just not culturally stigmatized in the way that it is for men.
We just have about 30 seconds left, but as a guy who struggled and ultimately came to terms with the sound of your voice, which I think is wonderful, did you was it difficult editing this film and hearing your voice, you know, looped over and over and over as you laid down the track?
It was very difficult to edit the film and constantly look at myself and hear myself. But I always encourage people to remember that who you see on screen is not me. You know, it is aspects of me. It's carefully chosen pieces of me. And in the process of making the film, I was, you know, extremely aware as well that, look, this isn't me. This is ultimately a character in a story. It happens to be drawn from real life. So that, you know, I was able to get through it. But I don't like to watch the film.
So it's that a good tells film. You something. You can watch it on demand. The film is called Do I Sound Gay? It also opens next Friday at the Texas Theater in Dallas. David Thorpe, thank you so much for spending this hour with us.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. The show's email is think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.